Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning to you on this Tuesday, the 10th of May. Welcome to DW's Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet. This program comes to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany, and here is what we've lined up for you today. Business comes to a standstill as El Nino rains cause landslides in different parts of Rwanda.
There's no movement, so whoever has business going on in the northern and southern province for now, they cannot move.
Congolese opposition presidential candidate Moise Katumbi is summoned to court over allegations of recruiting mercenaries.
This could be a message to Katumbi that he should watch out. That sort of thing happens all the time. And so I think that this is part of a generalized intimidation campaign against the opposition leader.
Stay tuned for these stories and more coming up shortly.
Top story.
We start in Rwanda, where El Nino rains have devastated lives of many people in different parts of the country. The rains have caused landslides, leaving several people dead. The incident adds to many El Nino-related catastrophes that have struck different parts of the African continent. Last month, a residential building collapsed in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, after days of flooding. Some 50 people died. In southern Africa, El Nino-induced drought has left thousands of people in dire need of food aid. On the latest development in Rwanda, my colleague Eunice Wanjiru spoke to DW's Nasra Bishumba.
It's true, this is not the first time something like this has happened, but this is the biggest disaster Rwanda has had in terms of floods. So far, according to the official numbers we have, at least 49 people have been killed by the floods and landslides, and around 442 houses have been destroyed, and they have left hundreds of people homeless. And at least 200 houses were completely destroyed in northern province alone. So far, also, we have the issue of crops that have been destroyed, many, many farms of beans, potatoes and bananas, as well as forests. The landslides have also blocked Kigali from connecting directly to the northern and southern parts of the country. That's so far what we know.
You've just mentioned that there's a road that has been blocked due to the flooding. What does this mean for Rwandans?
This means that there's no movement. So whoever has business going on in the northern and southern province for now, they cannot move. There's no movement till further notice because the flooding, the rains took 2 days. So maybe even clearing is going to take as long. So far... no business is going on in both provinces.
What is being done to cope with the damage caused and to assist the people in need?
Well, the Prime Minister and other high-profile officials traveled to the areas affected to console those who lost loved ones and those who lost property, but also to join these families as they lay those they lost to rest. But the Permanent Secretary at the Ministry of Disaster Management says that the government is ready to support the victims in any way possible. And so far, they have deployed a team which is assessing the damage so that they can provide immediate support in terms of basics. Maybe those who do not have housing, food, shelter, that kind of stuff.
Government officials have been held in meetings looking for ways to tackle this crisis. Do you have any information on how far they will proceed?
Not as yet. We do not know anything right now. What we know is that they will come out with an official statement, but what they are trying to do right now is to deal with the immediate effect, which is burying the dead and trying to help the survivors, because most of them do not have where to stay right now, where to live. They do not have a roof over their heads. They do not have food. That's what they are dealing with right now, but so far there's no official statement of the way forward.
Eunice Wanjiru speaking to Nasra Bishumba, who is right on the ground in Rwanda. Now, since El Nino-related calamities have increased, especially across East Africa, Africa Link thought to know what measures have been taken to help those affected. For that, Eunice Wanjiru again spoke to Hassan Musa of Red Cross.
Some counties, yes, we are prepared, and it's only that the expectation was for the last time, but now this one was not expected to be as bad as the previous preparation. But again, that has really helped in terms of preparedness, because people are prepared that anything can happen anytime, and they can say, and that's why you see even the death rate is not that much.
What have you done to assist those who have maybe lost their homes or are stranded?
What we've done so far is we've been able to distribute non-food items to over 5,000 households in Coast Province. That is in Tana River and Taita Taveta, Mombasa, Lamu and Kwale. But the worst hit was Kwale in Vanga, where we had 4,106 households affected, and we've been able to support them in non-food items. The county government also came in to support with food items to this community. And Taita Taveta, we did another 1,129 households affected. We've also supported them with the non-food items. That is an activity that is still going on in this area. Lamu is not that much affected, only with 18 households. Mombasa, 17 households, but the magnitude is not that much. Even Magarini in Kilifi County, compared to 3 years back when we had over 1,000 households, this time around was 67 households affected.
And what is Red Cross Kenya doing to prevent the spread of diseases that are brought by the floods? For example, the waterborne diseases that might come.
There's a lot of water purification that is going on, and we are doing this in collaboration with Ministry of Health, and a lot of sensitization with our volunteers going to affected areas to sensitize the community. Again, I'm sure you are aware that we have community volunteers in various areas, and these are the structures that we're using together with Ministry of Health to be able to support this community.
And what impact will the floods have in the availability of food security in Nairobi, for example? And what is Red Cross doing about it?
Probably I'll talk about Coast Province because that's my area. For Coast, especially these food basket areas like Taita Taveta, where we actually depend on the farmers in that area, it will really affect the community and even the other counties like Mombasa, which sometimes depend on this area. Definitely this will affect in long term.
What is Red Cross seeing that there might be an impact on food security?
What we're doing now is to mobilize resources to well-wishers and even the county government and federal government to support them in a temporary measure to support the community so that they can be able to give them food. But more important is to see once the water subsidized, then we are able to support this community.
Eunice Wanjiru speaking to Musa Hassan, a Kenyan Red Cross official on the coastal region. And we do apologize for that not-so-pleasant sound.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
And in DR Congo, an opposition presidential candidate denied accusations that he hired South African mercenaries as bodyguards. Moise Katumbi appeared before court on Monday amid cheers from his supporters. A rich businessman, Katumbi was a former governor of the mineral-rich Katanga province. He just announced his intention to contest for presidency. Human Rights Watch says the accusations against the opposition candidate appear to be politically motivated. Fred Muvunyi filed the following report.
The 51-year-old former governor of Katanga was an ally of President Kabila for near a decade, but he quit the ruling party in November over the president's plans to split several provinces, including Katanga. Last week, he was chosen by opposition parties to run against Kabila in elections due this year, but the dates have still not been announced, and there is mounting concern that Kabila might extend his tenure by changing the constitution. According to DW correspondent Kahozi Kosha in Lubumbashi, hundreds of people were on streets and several accompanied Katumbi inside the courtroom.
It was quite clear today while Katumbi was entering the court. He was accompanied by many people, and it was difficult for him to enter the courtroom due to the multitude. That shows that people don't believe in the allegations brought against him by the government of Kinshasa. But let's wait and see, because the government has said that it has evidence beyond reasonable doubt that Katumbi hired mercenaries and several people have been arrested.
On Wednesday, Justice Minister Alexis Thambwe Mwamba said he had ordered a probe into allegations that Katumbi had recruited foreign mercenaries, including Americans and South Africans. However, Katumbi said on Twitter that those accusations are unfounded, saying his opponents were simply looking to harm him and that he would never take up arms to secure power. The accusations came a day after he confirmed he would accept an opposition coalition's nomination as its presidential candidate. political expert on DR Congo, Jason Stans, believes that the allegations against Katumbi are far-fetched but are meant to serve as a warning.
This could be a message to Katumbi that he should watch out. That sort of thing happens all the time. There have been many other less subtle messages sent to Katumbi. There have been dozens of his supporters arrested around the country. The sons and family members of some of the leading politicians in his coalition and leading in the past couple of weeks have been arrested as well. And so I think that this is part of a generalized intimidation campaign against the opposition leader.
DR Congo authorities are under pressure from the international community to hold the presidential poll as planned in November before Kabila's second term expires in December. He has yet to announce clearly his plans, but contrary to the constitution, which only allows a two-term limit, some of his party members have asked him to run again, a proposal that has solicited protest across DRC. However, Stans says Kabila is in a difficult position now.
He received a lot of fierce resistance from various sectors, the Catholic Church, civil society, diplomats, opposition parties. And so he retreated, I think, from that option. But it's still an option. He could name a successor to succeed him, to guarantee his interests, the interests of his political family. He's in a very difficult position. I think that the default option for him is to play for time.
Last month, police in the southeast of the country fired tear gas to break up a demonstration of around 5,000 people in the latest unrest triggered by fears that Kabila plans to extend his rule into a third term.
Fred Mavonye reporting.
Africa on the move.
In our Africa on the Move segment, we look at a group of Nigerian scientists who have come up with a new simple method for diagnosing malaria. Now, they are first in the list of nominees for the African Innovation Foundation's Innovation Prize for Africa 2016. The urine test for malaria is a rapid non-blood diagnostic medical device that can diagnose malaria in less than 25 minutes. Unlike the old method, which requires health personnel to carry out malaria tests through blood samples in a laboratory, people can now test themselves for the disease at home. The new method has been introduced into the Nigerian market in collaboration with the country's Ministry of Health. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
From a pediatric clinic in Lagos, children crying in pain after health workers pierce their thumbs with medical needles to extract blood samples for malaria tests. But a new malaria test could soon put an end to the pain and tears of these children. With just a urine test kit, one can diagnose malaria by merely putting a strip in a small container of urine. A line shows on the strip if one has the malaria parasite. Dr. Eddie Agbo is chairman of the US-based Phidobar Technologies, the company that developed the new method. He says it has a lot of advantages over the use of blood to test for malaria.
This is the first non-blood test for malaria. It is one step. You just dip it in the sample, leave it there for 25 minutes and read the results. You don't have to mix anything, you don't have to add any chemicals, no reagents are needed, no equipment needed. So it's just as simple as ABC. Again, it's very, very similar to a pregnancy test that uses urine. So this is the only test that can actually be appropriately positioned as a home test for malaria. And that's why we think it's a major milestone.
Many Nigerians are usually reluctant to go to hospital and be tested for malaria. This means they end up treating the disease without any test to prove that they even had it in the first place. Vivian Adebola is one of such Nigerians. She says it is convenient to go on self-medication rather than wasting time in the hospital waiting for the blood test.
When you have malaria, you just go on self-medication because most times you may not have what it takes to go to a lab for a lab test before treating yourself on malaria. For example, when you go to all these health centers around, you take your time like from morning till afternoon because they have so many people on the queue for that test. So the alternative is to go for self-medication.
Many like Adebola wrongly assume that all fevers are caused by malaria. Medical practitioners hope that because the urine-based test can be done at home, It will encourage people to test and confirm that they actually have malaria before taking drugs for the ailment. Dr. Umar Oluwole Sander, National President of Nigeria's Healthcare Providers Association, says the abuse of malaria drugs was what made the malaria parasite to be resistant to chloroquine, the drug formerly used to treat the tropical disease. He says the urine-based test will help curb the abuse of the new class of malaria drugs known as ACT, since people can now easily test for the parasite.
Without a positive test for malaria, you don't treat for malaria. This was what happened to chloroquine. Chloroquine was overabused. It became resistant. We couldn't use it again. Now, we don't want to abuse the ACT. With the introduction of this new product, using urine to test for malaria parasite, it will go a long way to help many practitioners.
Apart from Nigeria, there are now plans to introduce the urine test kit in other African countries and Asia. The two continents account for many of the 425 million malaria cases worldwide and the more than 400,000 deaths resulting from the ailment annually.
Some great African brains there, and Sam Olukoya prepared that report. Now, Kenyan cartoonist Godfrey Mwapwemba, also known as Gado, is well known for criticizing the government and politicians through his cartoons. The renowned satirist says Kenyan politicians have tightened the grip on the media. He visited our DW studios in Bonn, and I had a chat with him about the future of satire in Africa. Take a listen.
I think in many ways it has always been a tool for communication when it comes to different issues. I think what we have seen in recent years is an explosion of that, because there have been a lot of outlets, there have been many news stations, there have been many TV stations, and there is a huge demand for content. In that sense, there has been huge growth in that area.
Why do you find it important to communicate via satire? In other words, where do you draw your inspiration?
Well, there's plenty of inspiration in many African countries. I think I always say that you need to walk from one street corner to the other to get what to draw or what to say. But satire is important because it can discuss any other issue out there. Because of the use of humor, it makes it easy for people to listen or to discuss different issues.
You talk about satire being, you know, a tool to communicate sensitive issues in a more humorous way, so to say.
Sure.
What are some of the most interesting topics you deal with mostly?
As a satirist and as a cartoonist, I think political issues are always number one. But, you know, I don't discriminate. I've very much discussed religious issues, which are always very sensitive. I've always discussed gender issues, issues about gays and lesbians. These are issues that are very sensitive, and issues about ethnicity and many other issues. And so, as I said, it's actually satire, you know, allows one to talk about these issues easily. And
you recently complained about government influence in your job, such that your contract with the Daily Nation was not renewed. What steps have you taken so far to ensure that you're not silenced?
Well, there is a lot one can do. In number one, is I still continue to publish online. But what has happened is that this is something that I've said. You have individuals in the media who are in complicity with the government, and that makes it's a worrying trend in many in Kenya and other East African countries. But having said that, pressures have always been there, even in the past, I think, and it's understandable in my craft to have that.
Now, my very final question is, what is the future of satire in Kenya and perhaps in Africa?
Well, despite the difficulties that have been seen, I mean, the future is very bright. I remain very optimistic. I think you are going to have these challenges now and then. It's normal.
Kenyan cartoonist Godfrey Mwapwemba.
Making a difference.
In Ghana, environmental activists are worried about increased deforestation resulting from human activity. Under the auspices of Community Development Alliance, they have started a campaign to minimize the illegal cutting of trees. Isaac Kalechi reports.
I am at the Achimota Forest in southern Ghana. It's a forest reserve that means a lot to Ghanaians, as it serves as the location for one of Ghana's best-known game reserves. Early this year, Achimota Forest was nearly burnt down by a wildfire, but thanks to firefighters, it was salvaged. But north of the country's savanna zone, forest reserves like this one are under siege from human activities, particularly the indiscriminate felling of trees.
We're taking a walk from one tree to the other, just looking at.
That's Bernard Saibu, a native of northern Ghana, taking a team of journalists around the forest reserves mostly affected by deforestation. Once the trees are cut down, they are locked and then transported. Yusuf Wahid is a local representative in one of the worst affected communities called Yezizi. He says the locals don't benefit from the illegal trade of timber.
The benefit is not there. We don't have a particular channel or means of getting something which will devolve the community. When the people are in, they see the chiefs. Even before you get to know, some of them might have been in the bush. When they finish, they load, then they will give the chief his cola. I wish if we can put some measures to send them away.
Wahid's call to stop deforestation has been taken up by the advocacy group Community Development Alliance. The group is dedicated to fighting illegal felling of trees in parts of the country. Yusuf Salifu Kantong, the executive director, says instead of government officials becoming part of the solution, they have instead become part of the problem.
Now we also have evidence to prove that the recent destruction of the environment in the northern parts of Ghana, particularly in the Upper West region, was orchestrated by government institutions, particularly the Ministry of Lands and Natural Resources, were these agencies of the Forestry Commission, who do have a responsibility to ensure that the environment is protected.
In 2014, when Enusa Fusheni was still Minister of Lands and Natural Resources, he put in place measures to regulate the felling of trees in Ghana's forest. But after Enusa's exit, the practice resumed after the ministry issued a letter allowing unrestricted export of wood. This is an issue that worries the former minister.
So that I can see that from the letter, yes. I can see that, and that doesn't help the monitoring, that doesn't help regulation. That doesn't help our fight against the felling of rosewood. That doesn't help protect the environment in the north.
Two-thirds of the country is already classified as savanna woodland. The Forestry Commission, in charge of protecting the forest reserves, appears helpless. Raphael Yeboah is executive director of the commission.
I went to the Damango area to try and convince the local people that, look here, we are destroying our environment. Then the Damango Ura, I met him, we sat down. He told me that, gentlemen, this rosewood gave me this ambulance which takes my people to hospital. So we cannot stop. We left the matter to the politicians to take.
Hopefully, Yusuf's work will soon yield some fruit, but that largely depends on the support he receives from all who wish to protect Ghana's forest from disappearing completely.
Isaac Kalechi in Ghana. And before we leave, here is a reminder of our main stories. Landslides caused by heavy rains have killed nearly 50 people and left hundreds homeless in Rwanda. Congolese opposition presidential candidate Moise Katumbi appeared in court but denied charges of hiring foreign mercenaries. And Nigerian scientists came up with a new simple method for diagnosing malaria. That's all we had for you today. Thank you for listening. I am Jen Ayeko Kumet. Have a nice day. We'll be right back.